Chapter 66. From the workshop of the Golden Key, there issued forth a tinkling sound, so merry and good-humored, that it suggested the idea of someone working blithely, and made quite pleasant music. No man who hammered on at a dull monotonous duty could have brought such cheerful notes from steel and iron. None but a chirping, healthy, honest-hearted fellow, who made the best of everything, and felt kindly towards everybody, could have done it for an instant. He might have been a coppersmith, and still been musical. If he had sat in a jolting wagon, full of rods of iron, it seemed as if he would have brought some harmony out of it. Tink, 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 clear as a silver bell, and audible at every pause of the street's harsher noises, as though it said, "I don't care, nothing puts me out, I am resolved to be happy." Apostrophe women scolded, children squalled, heavy carts went rumbling by, horrible cries proceeded from the lungs of hawkers. Still it struck in again, no higher, no lower, no louder, no softer, not thrusting itself on people's notice a bit the more for having been outdone by louder sounds. Tink, 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 tink. It was a perfect embodiment of the still small voice, free from all cold, hoarseness, huskiness, or unhealthiness of any kind. Foot passengers slackened their pace, and were disposed to linger near it. Neighbors who had got up splenetic that morning, felt good humor stealing on them as they heard it, and by degrees became quite sprightly. Mothers danced their babies to its ringing. Still the same magical tink, 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 came gaily from the workshop of the Golden Key. Who but the locksmith could have made such music? A gleam of sun shining through the unsashed window, and checkering the dark workshop with a broad patch of light, fell full upon him, as though attracted by his sunny heart. There he stood working at his anvil, his face all radiant with exercise and gladness, his sleeves turned up, his wig pushed off his shining forehead, the easiest, freest, happiest man in all the world. Beside him sat a sleek cat, purring, and winking in the light, and falling every now and then into an idle doze, as from excess of comfort. Toby looked on from a tall bench hard by, one beaming smile, from his broad nut-brown face down to the slack-baked buckles in his shoes. The very locks that hung around had something jovial in their rust, and seemed like gouty gentlemen of hearty natures, disposed to joke on their infirmities. There was nothing surly or severe in the whole scene. It seemed impossible that any one of the innumerable keys could fit a churlish strong box or a prison door. Cellars of beer and wine, rooms where there were fires, books, gossip, and cheering laughter, these were their proper sphere of action. Pluses of distrust and cruelty and restraint, they would have left quadruple locked forever. Tink, tink, tink. The locksmith paused at last, and wiped his brow. The silence roused the cat, who, jumping softly down, crept to the door, and watched with tiger eyes a birdcage in an opposite window. Gabriel lifted Toby to his mouth, and took a hearty draught. Then, as he stood upright, with his head flung back, and his portly chest thrown out, you would have seen that Gabriel's lower man was clothed in military gear. Glancing at the wall beyond, there might have been espied, hanging on there several pegs, a cap and feather, broadsword, sash, and coat of scarlet, which any man learned in such matters would have known from their make and pattern to be the uniform of a sergeant in the Royal East London Volunteers. As the locksmith put his mug down, empty, on the bench whence it had smiled on him before, he glanced at these articles with a laughing eye, and looking at them with his head a little on one side, as though he would get them all into a focus, said, leaning on his hammer, "Time was, now, I remember, when I was like to run mad with the desire to wear a coat of that color. If anyone, except my father, had called me a fool for my pains, how I should have fired and fumed. But what a fool I must have been, sure lie. Apostrophe, ah. Apostrophe, apostrophe," sighed Mrs. Varden, who had entered unobserved. "A fool indeed. A man at your time of life, Varden, should know better now. apostrophe, why, what a ridiculous woman you are, Martha, apostrophe, said the locksmith, turning round with a smile. Certainly, apostrophe, replied Mrs. Five, with great demureness. Of course I am. I know that, Varden. Thank you. Apostrophe, began the locksmith. Yes, apostrophe, said his wife, I know what you mean. You speak quite plain enough to be understood, Varden. It's very kind of you to adapt yourself to my capacity, I am sure. Apostrophe, tut, tut, Martha, apostrophe, rejoined the locksmith. Don't take offense at nothing. I mean, how strange it is of you to run down volunteering, when it's done to defend you and all the other women, and our own fireside and everybody else's, in case of need. Apostrophe, it's unchristian, apostrophe, cried Mrs. Varden, shaking her head. Unchristian. Apostrophe, said the locksmith. Why, what the devil, apostrophe, Mrs. Varden looked at the ceiling, as in expectation, that the consequence of this profanity, would be the immediate descent of the four-post bedstead on the second floor, together with the best sitting room on the first. But no visible judgment occurring, she heaved a deep sigh, and begged her husband, in a tone of resignation, to go on, and by all means, to blaspheme as much as possible, because he knew she liked it. The locksmith did for a moment seem disposed to gratify her, but he gave a great gulp, and mildly rejoined. I was going to say, what on earth, do you call it unchristian for? Which would be most unchristian, Martha, to sit quietly down, and let our houses be sacked by a foreign army, or to turn out like men, and drive 'em off? Shouldn't I be a nice sort of a Christian, if I crept into a corner of my own chimney, and looked on while a parcel of whiskered savages bore off Dolly or you? Apostrophe, when he said are you, apostrophe, Mrs. Varden, despite herself, relaxed into a smile. There was something complimentary in the idea. In such a state of things as that, indeed, apostrophe, she simpered. As that. Apostrophe, repeated the locksmith. Well, that would be the state of things directly. Even Mix would go. Some black tambourine player, with a great turban on, would be bearing her off, and, unless the tambourine player was proof against kicking and scratching, it's my belief he'd have the worst of it. Ha ha ha! I'd forgive the tambourine player. I wouldn't have him interfered with on any account, poor fellow. Apostrophe, and here the locksmith laughed again so heartily, that tears came into his eyes, much to Mrs. Varden's indignation, who thought the capture of so sound a Protestant, and estimable a private character as mixed by a pagan negro, a circumstance too shocking and awful for contemplation. The picture Gabriel had drawn, indeed, threatened serious consequences, and would indubitably have led to them, but luckily at that moment a light footstep crossed the threshold, and Dolly, running in, threw her arms round her old father's neck, and hugged him tight. Here she is at last. Apostrophe, cried Gabriel. And how well you look, doll, and how late you are, my darling. Apostrophe, how well she looked? Well? Why, if he had exhausted every laudatory adjective in the dictionary, it wouldn't have been praise enough. When and where was there ever such a plump, roguish, comely, bright-eyed, enticing, bewitching, captivating, maddening little puss in all this world, as Dolly? What was the Dolly of 5 years ago, to the Dolly of that day? How many coachmakers, saddlers, cabinet makers, and professors of other useful arts, had deserted their fathers, mothers, sisters, brothers, and, most of all, their cousins, for the love of her? How many unknown gentlemen supposed to be of mighty fortunes, if not titles, had waited round the corner after dark, and tempted Mix the Incorruptible, with golden guineas, to deliver offers of marriage folded up in love letters? How many disconsolate fathers and substantial tradesmen had waited on the locksmith for the same purpose, with dismal tales of how their sons had lost their appetites, and taken to shut themselves up in dark bedrooms, and wandering in desolate suburbs with pale faces, and all because of Dolly Varden's loveliness and cruelty. How many young men, in all previous times of unprecedented steadiness, had turned suddenly wild and wicked for the same reason, and, in an ecstasy of unrequited love, taken to wrench off door knockers, and invert the boxes of rheumatic watchmen. How had she recruited the king's service, both by sea and land, through rendering desperate his loving subjects between the ages of 18 and 25? How many young ladies had publicly professed, with tears in their eyes, that for their tastes she was much too short, too tall, too bold, too cold, too stout, too thin, too fair, too dark, to everything but handsome. How many old ladies, taking counsel together, had thanked heaven their daughters were not like her, and had hoped she might come to no harm, and had thought she would come to no good, and had wondered what people saw in her, and had arrived at the conclusion that she was going off in her looks, or had never come on in them, and that she was a thorough imposition and a popular mistake. And yet here was this same Dolly Varden, so whimsical and hard to please, that she was Dolly Varden still, all smiles and dimples and pleasant looks, and caring no more for the 50 or 60 young fellows who at that very moment were breaking their hearts to marry her, than if so many oysters had been crossed in love and opened afterwards. Dolly hugged her father as has been already stated, and having hugged her mother also, accompanied both into the little parlor, where the cloth was already laid for dinner, and where Miss Mix, a trifle more rigid and bony than of yore, received her with a sort of hysterical gasp, intended for a smile. Into the hands of that young virgin, she delivered her bonnet and walking dress, all of a dreadful, artful, and designing kind, and then said with a laugh, which rivaled the locksmith's music, "How glad I always am to be at home again." ... "And how glad we always are, Doll," said her father, putting back the dark hair from her sparkling eyes, "to have you at home. Give me a kiss." If there had been anybody of the male kind there to see her do it, but there was not, it was a mercy. "I don't like your being at the Warren," said the locksmith. "I can't bear to have you out of my sight. And what is the news over yonder, Doll?" "What news there is, I think you know already," replied his daughter. "I am sure you do, though." cried the locksmith. "What's that?" "Come, come," said Dolly, "you know very well. I want you to tell me why Mr. Airedale, oh, how gruff he is again, to be sure, has been away from home for some days past, and why he is traveling about." "We know he is traveling, because of his letters, without telling his own niece why or wherefore." "Miss Emma doesn't want to know, I'll swear," returned the locksmith. "I don't know that," said Dolly, "but I do, at any rate. Do tell me. Why is he so secret, and what is this ghost story, which nobody is to tell Miss Emma, and which seems to be mixed up with his going away? Now I see you know by your coloring so." "What the story means, or is, or has to do with it, I know no more than you, my dear," returned the locksmith, "except that it's some foolish fear of little Solomon's which has, indeed, no meaning in it, I suppose. As to Mr. Airedale's journey, he goes, as I believe, said Dolly. "As I believe," resumed the locksmith, pinching her cheek, "on business, Doll. What it may be, is quite another matter. Read Bluebeard, and don't be too curious, pet. It's no business of yours or mine, depend upon that. And here's dinner, which is much more to the purpose." Dolly might have remonstrated against this summary dismissal of the subject, notwithstanding the appearance of dinner, but at the mention of Bluebeard, Mrs. Varden interposed, protesting she could not find it in her conscience to sit tamely by, and hear her child recommended to peruse the adventures of a Turk and Muslim, far less of a fabulous Turk, which she considered that potentate to be. She held that, in such stirring and tremendous times as those in which they lived, it would be much more to the purpose, if Dolly became a regular subscriber to the Thunderer, where she would have an opportunity of reading Lord George Gordon's speeches word for word, which would be a greater comfort and solace to her, than 150 Bluebeards ever could impart. She appealed in support of this proposition to Miss Mix, then in waiting, who said that indeed the peace of mind she had derived from the perusal of that paper generally, but especially of one article of the very last week as ever was, entitled Great Britain Drenched in Gore, apostrophe exceeded all belief. The same composition, she added, had also wrought such a comforting effect on the mind of a married sister of hers, then resident at Golden Lion Court, number 27, second bell handle on the right-hand doorpost, that, being in a delicate state of health, and in fact expecting an addition to her family, she had been seized with fits directly after its perusal, and had raved of the Inquisition ever since, to the great improvement of her husband and friends. Miss Mix went on to say, that she would recommend all those whose hearts were hardened to hear Lord George themselves, whom she commended first, in respect of his steady Protestantism, then of his oratory, then of his eyes, then of his nose, then of his legs, and lastly of his figure generally, which she looked upon as fit for any statue, prince, or angel, to which sentiment Mrs. Varden fully subscribed. Mrs. Varden, having cut in, looked at a box upon the mantel shelf, painted in imitation of a very red brick dwelling house, with a yellow roof, having atop a real chimney, down which voluntary subscribers dropped their silver, gold, or pence, into the parlor, and on the door the counterfeit presentment of a brass plate, whereon was legibly inscribed Protestant Association, and looking at it, said, that it was to her a source of poignant misery to think that Varden never had, of all his substance, dropped anything into that temple, save once in secret as she afterwards discovered two fragments of tobacco pipe, which she hoped, would not be put down to his last account. That Dolly, she was grieved to say, was no less backward in her contributions, better loving, as it seemed, to purchase ribbons and such gauds, than to encourage the great cause, then in such heavy tribulation, and that she did entreat her father she much feared could not be moved, not to despise, but imitate, the bright example of Miss Mix, who flung her wages, as it were, into the very countenance of the Pope, and bruised his features with her quarter's money. Oh, Mim, apostrophe said Mix, don't relude to that. I had no intentions, Mim, that nobody should know. Such sacrifices as I can make, are quite a widow's mite. It's all I have, apostrophe cried Mix with a great burst of tears, for with her, they never came on by degrees, but it's made up to me in other ways, it's well made up. Apostrophe, this was quite true, though not perhaps in the sense that Mix intended. As she never failed to keep her self-denial full in Mrs. Varden's view, it drew forth so many gifts of caps and gowns and other articles of dress, that upon the whole the red brick house was perhaps the best investment for her small capital she could. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.